about human exceptionalism, as I promised last week. We'll get to that. But I don't know about you. I mean, how many of you have met somebody this past week who's worried about the coronavirus? Okay, virtually all of you. All right. You know, since things have gotten a little more than it was a week ago, this has been the most frequent question I've been asked this past week. If there's a good, all-powerful, all-loving God out there, why would he create viruses? And why would he put us at risk of something like the coronavirus, COVID-19, that's going around right now? All right, if you haven't met people that are worried about this virus, I promise you, within a week or two, you're going to meet a lot more. Because it's already here, and it's going to have a more of an impact than it has so far. But what I wanted to do is equip you, because I know you're going to get asked this question, and it's a great opportunity to really expose people to the Christian faith. So one of the good things about this virus is the opportunity it's going to give for us who are believers to be able to share with people why there really is a good, all-powerful God out there, all-loving God, and why he would create viruses. And so I want to begin by looking at the benefits of viruses. We wouldn't be here without viruses. And so this is a partial review of the benefits we get from viruses. The first life that God created on planet Earth were bacteria, microbes. And we need microbes. Microbes were crucial to build up the oxygen in the atmosphere that we, who are animals, need to breathe. They're also crucial for chemically transforming the planet so that you could have megafauna on the planet. That's a term that means big life forms. You need 3 billion years of microbial activity to make that chemical transformation so this planet becomes a safe, optimal place for plants and animals. The problem, however, is that bacteria literally take over if you let them. And so what we notice is that we have viruses at the same time we see the first microbes. So viruses have been here for 3.8 billion years. Just like microbes, bacteria have been here for 3.8 billion years. One reason we know the viruses were here when God first created the bacteria is that if it wasn't for the viruses, planet Earth would have very quickly have become a gigantic bacterial slime ball. The bacteria would just have kept multiplying and multiplying, would take over everything, and there'd be no room for any other life forms. Now, we do see bacterial slimes in different places on the planet, but our whole planet is not a bacterial slime ball. And the reason why is that the viruses keep the bacteria in check. In fact, there are some scientific theories that believe that the bacteria were the source of the viruses. Because if a bacteria gets damaged, you get genetic material that escapes, and that could have been the source of the first viruses. But the viruses attack and break up the bacteria and prevent the bacteria from literally taking over the whole world. I mean, you can do experiments. You can do a thing in a lab or at home where you basically protect the bacteria from any viral attack, and you just see how rapidly they multiply. I mean, literally within hours, the bacteria have multiplied to a great degree. And that's fairly well known in the scientific community, that we need viruses, and we need viruses at about the population and diversity level we see here on planet Earth to keep the bacteria at the optimum. You don't want the viruses to be so prevalent and virulent that they wipe out all the bacteria. We need bacteria. You can't survive without bacteria. Many of you may not realize that your body has 10 times more bacterial cells than it has human body cells. So we're literally walking homes for bacteria. And that's crucial, because without that bacteria, we couldn't digest our food. And so they play a crucial role just in our survival. And incidentally, I'd encourage you, don't overdo that antibacterial soap that they sell, because you need bacteria on your skin to prevent your skin from being corroded away. So the bacteria actually give you a shield. Healthy skin, you need some bacteria, not too much, but the bottom line is We have bacteria on planet Earth at just the optimal diversity and population levels to make sure that bacteria remain at the optimal diversity and population levels to make animal and plant life not only possible, but optimal on the face of the Earth. And number two, viruses play a crucial role in the water cycle. We had rain this morning. Viruses are responsible for a lot of the rain that falls. Why? Because you can't get rain, you can't get snow without a seed. You need a tiny seed that's able to collect the water molecules and form a raindrop or a snowflake. And viruses are optimal at giving you that just right seed that allows the raindrop to form or the snowflake to form. Viruses contribute to rainfall and snowfall in another way. They attack the bacteria and break up the bacteria in what they call these little tiny bacterial phages, and they also provide seeds for the formation of raindrops and dew and snowflakes and hail, etc. So we would have a very much reduced water cycle if it wasn't for viruses. You say, what are you talking about? The majority of the rain and the snow we get can be traced back to bacteria, either directly or indirectly, to the way they break up the bacteria that's here. And also they contribute to the carbon cycle. I mean, after all, viral particles are carbonaceous material, and therefore they help in the cycling of carbon throughout the environment. And this last one is still being studied, because we know that viruses can cause certain cancers, but we also know that certain viruses actually ward off cancers. And so, for example, if you never get flu, you never get the common cold, you never get a viral attack, it makes you more subject to certain cancers. But the caveat is, there's also certain viruses that actually bring about cancers. So this is still being researched. And also there's a new technology, something that Fuzz wrote in our new book, Humans 2.0, that came out from Reasons to Believe. There's now new technology where they're using viruses, where they basically structure the viruses in the lab and use them as a way to get into your body and go after the cancers. And so we may be able to see a lot more recovery from cancer as what they call viral therapy. You know, basically taking viruses, designing them, and engineering them in such a way that they can attack the cancers. So bottom line is, we should all be thanking God for viruses. We wouldn't be here without viruses. Viruses are a good thing. However, viruses are like mosquitoes. We don't like mosquitoes. They bite us, they give us diseases. But who was responsible for mosquitoes getting out of control? I mean, there's, what, 226 different mosquito species in the world? Only six of them bite humans. And where did those mosquitoes live? Well, before we humans messed things up, those mosquitoes were living in places where humans didn't live. And so we weren't bothered by mosquitoes. I don't think there were mosquitoes in the Garden of Eden. However, there's now mosquitoes virtually everywhere in the world. Why? Because we humans have brought these mosquitoes that God never really intended to have contact with human beings, and we literally transported them all over the world. You may be aware of this, that 100 years ago, there wasn't a single mosquito in the Hawaiian Islands. But it was tourists coming to Hawaii that brought the mosquitoes with them. And now there's mosquitoes. Incidentally, there's still places in Hawaii that you can visit that are mosquito-free. And what's amazing is the big swamps on Kauai, they're mosquito-free, at least for now. Every year that goes by, the mosquitoes go a little higher up on the mountains of the Hawaiian island chain. But there are mosquitoes at the coast, but they're not yet at the mountains. But again, 100 years ago, no mosquitoes at all. So, and this kind of really brings up the point about the viruses. Yeah, you're all concerned about this coronavirus is out there. What brought about these killer viruses? By the way, this isn't the first killer virus. I mean, back in 1918, 1919, right after World War I, there was a pandemic, a viral pandemic, that ranks as the worst pandemic of the past 200 years. And, you know, I got a book coming out in April, April 2nd, Weathering Climate Change. And when I was writing the book, I had this section about things that could be bad for human civilization besides climate change. And I had this long section on pandemics. The editors chopped it down to just two short paragraphs. I kind of wish I'd left it in there, given what's happening today, because it would have been perfect for what's going on. But I'm actually going to be doing a little video for Reasons to Believe and putting out an article. And of course, we got a full-time virologist on the staff of Reasons to Believe, and Jeanette Roberts, and she'll be producing articles and videos as well. But here's the point, is that viruses are like mosquitoes in that, you know, God created them, but it's because of human sin we've made mosquitoes a lot more deleterious to our livelihood than would otherwise have been the case. And the same thing is true of viruses, is that we are the ones that are responsible for these viruses getting to a dangerous level, like we see with what happened with the flu outbreak back in 1918, and what is happening now with the coronavirus. Now, viruses become dangerous because they mutate. And so, you know, we get the common cold, and by the way, the common cold is a coronavirus. Flus are coronavirus, so it's just another form of the common cold or the flu. What makes them deadly is when they mutate one or more times, and our human immune system is not prepared to deal with the mutation. And so we wind up with a much more catastrophic health consequence, because this is not like the viruses that the human immune system is designed to deal with. And what causes these viruses to mutate to a point where they become dangerous is when you crowd together domesticated animals, or you crowd together humans, or you crowd together both humans and these domesticated animals. Because what's happening is you have, say, a lot of animals, birds or mammals, jammed very tightly together, millions of them jammed very tightly together. It makes the perfect environment for a virus to mutate, because it just has many more opportunities to multiply amongst the different animals or the humans. And this was noticed in World War II, for example, that a lot of people died in the Jewish ghettos because they were just jammed so tightly together. And it gave these different viruses an opportunity to multiply and to mutate. And that's also what they believe happened in 1918. You know, World War I, you had these soldiers jammed very tightly together in these trenches, and they were all, okay, we got a question here, go for it.
Yes, I don't think you've answered this yet. I was distracted trying to get the microphone, but do we understand the mechanism that causes viruses to mutate into other new forms of viruses, the actual mechanism?
Well, we understand the mechanism to this degree, that just like with all life forms, if you've got a very large population with a very quick generation time jammed tightly together, that's where you're going to get the highest probability of mutations happening. And so bacteria mutate at a much more rapid rate than we human beings, because they're tiny. They exist at populations levels that are billions of times greater than what we exist. I mean, consider this, 1 ton of Earth's soil has 100 quadrillion microbes in it. So you've got this huge population, they can reproduce in 20 minutes. So wherever you've got a very rapid reproduction time, and where you've got an enormous population, where you've got relatively simple DNA, you've got an opportunity for mutations to take place. Now, you're going to get, most mutations are neutral. They're not bad, they're not good. And then when you compare the ones that are bad to the ones that are good for the organism, it's likely a 10,000 to 1 ratio, or a million-to-one ratio. And so beneficial mutations are extremely rare compared to the deleterious mutations. And here we're talking about a mutation that's not bad for the virus, but it's bad for the host. And ultimately, that's bad for the virus. I mean, you know, if you're a parasite, the last thing you want to do is to kill your host. Because when you kill your host, you die too. And that explains, for example, why the SARS virus was relatively easy to bring under control because of the high death rate. And what that did is it also killed the virus because they no longer had a host. So, well, yes. Yeah, go ahead. Then we got another question. Well, what I'm saying is that when you've got a dense population of animals where the viruses are living within those animals, that's an environment where you've got a much higher probability of one of those viruses mutating, and then when it mutates, it can spread throughout that population. And in places where you've got these animals jammed tightly together, all getting sick from the virus, where you've got close human contact with them, some viruses, and the coronaviruses are well known to do this, some viruses are not able to jump from one species to another species. But one thing we know about the coronavirus, it is able to jump from birds and mammals to other bird and mammal species and to human beings. And so that's why they think this new virus happened in Wuhan, which is a city of 10 million people in China. It's a city where people are jammed much more tightly together than they are here in American cities. And it's also a place where they have domesticated animals living in very high population, dense regions. And basically, it's places where people go and they say, I want that chicken. The chicken's still alive. They kill the chicken and they give it to you, and that's dinner for tonight. So this is where you've got people jammed tightly together with animals jammed tightly together. Then it's easy for a virus to jump from those animals to those human beings. Incidentally, the jury is still out exactly how this virus got into the human population. But that's kind of the predominant hypothesis, is this is what happened. Okay, we got a question back here, yes.
Yeah, I was gonna say the same thing about Wuhan, China, and how dense population is, but they've always had these live markets. They've always been eating these animals. So why within the 2 months did it all hit so hard now?
Well, that's a good point. If you've got domesticated animals and the millions jammed very tightly together, along with millions of human beings in close contact with them, that doesn't guarantee you're gonna get a viral outbreak like this. It can happen, and all you need to do is go back a decade to the SARS outbreak. That too was traced to overcrowded domesticated animals in close contact with overcrowded human beings, which is why people are thinking this is the same kind of thing. So SARS outbreak happened in China under very similar conditions. But the whole point is, we see commands in the Bible, be kind to your animals. Jamming them tightly together where they're under extreme stress is not a good thing for the animals and not a good thing for you. The meat will be better if the animals are treated well. So there's multiple commands in the Proverbs that we're to be kind to our animals, take good care of them, don't jam them so tightly together where they're under extreme stress, because when under extreme stress, they're gonna be more susceptible to a viral attack. I mean, that's true of us human beings as well. If you overwork human beings and put them under extreme stress, they're more likely to get the cold or the flu, which is why they tell you, if you want to avoid getting these viruses, make sure you get plenty of rest and make sure your body is not experiencing extreme stress. Okay, we have a question here, yes.
What's interesting about this case, because you're right, SARS, I think they attributed to some natural mechanism, although pushed by conditions. And the flu of 1918, there was no biological weapons research, but in Wuhan is the Liberation Army's biological weapons facility, and they just arrested a academic in America from Harvard who was making a lot of trips to Wuhan, and his field of expertise goes along those lines. So there may be something that's sin-based in this one rather than simply nature-based. It may have been pushed a little bit by human sin, this condition.
Yeah, there's still a lot of speculation about
that. We'll probably never know, actually.
Right. Okay. The other factor is that we should avoid too much. You got a question? Go ahead.
Yeah. Just to put it simply, the way a virus can mutate, a virus, when it infects a bacterial cell, will go in and actually give the bacteria some of its DNA, and it'll become part of the bacteria's plasmid. And then another type of virus from another animal could go in, take that DNA back out of the bacteria, and have new traits. So that type of mutation can occur too.
Right.
It's just exchanging DNA using a bacterial host, and it's very effective at creating new species or new varieties of contagions.
Right. Okay. Point three was that when you got too much contact between humans and animals, that's another way that you can get these viruses forming. And there is a lot of evidence that that's what's going on in Wuhan, is you had millions of people in contact with millions of these animals, and they were getting repeated close contact. You know, the thing about viruses too is that if your body gets exposed to millions of viral particles in a short time period, as opposed to just thousands in a long time period, you're more likely to get sick. And so it's the repeated contact that can make for an especially pernicious attack. And you know, there's a lot of talk about the fact that it's people that have a compromised immune system, who are older and not very healthy, those are the ones that are dying. But there was a young doctor in his 30s in Wuhan who passed away from this virus, and they now recognize he was treating all these coronaviral patients, and he was overworking himself. So even though he was healthy and strong in his 30s, the fact that he was overworked and under high stress and getting repeated contacts with the virus because of his treatment of vulnerable patients, this is why he wound up dying. But yeah, go ahead.
Well, I just thought I should mention this latest variety is the same class as an ordinary cold would be. Colds are also coronaviruses. Now, it has a poor survival rate, about only 98% recover. And most of those that don't are indeed impaired from the beginning. But I thought I should report an experience that I've had. I used to get a flu or cold once or twice a year. And then I started taking 7,000 units of vitamin D3 every day with a meal with fat, and also made sure I get 1 to 2 grams of vitamin C in divided doses. I never got sick once, except one time I spent all day with my sister that had a terrible flu. She said it had been going on for more than a week. And a few days later, I started to feel a little off, and I thought I did pick up something. And then I just went into what I call a response mode, taking 5,000 units of D3 every 2 hours and 500 milligrams of vitamin C every 2 hours. And within 6 hours, I was normal. So the real key to you don't need to wait. In fact, it's better than a vaccine. The vaccines for even the flu have been shown to be only about 30% effective. The real key to avoid succumbing is to have a strong immune system, and that includes getting lots of sleep, at least 6 or 7 hours of good sleep. And then if you ever do feel sick, to get real warm, close to sweating, lots of rest and relaxation right away. And most people, your immune system will protect you better than any of the medical strategies that might be presented.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, the U.S. population tends to not have sufficient vitamin D in their bodies because we spend so much time indoors. So taking vitamin D supplement, vitamin C as well. But I caution you, don't overdo it. I mean, what you're talking about is doing an overdose for a limited time window. You don't want to extend that. Too much vitamin C. For example, notice we humans, like the guinea pigs and the great apes, we don't make our own vitamin C. We have very efficient recycling systems. Animals that do make their own vitamin C flood their bodies with huge amounts of vitamin C. You don't want to do that if you want to live to be 70, 80, 90 years and have and be mentally sharp. Too much vitamin C flowing through your brain, for example, will cause the capillaries in the brain to begin to bleed, and that's not good. You're only going to live for 5 or 10 years, like most life forms here on planet Earth. Don't worry about it. And so they're able to tolerate much higher levels of vitamin C simply because they're not going to live long enough to accumulate the damage. But we will. And so, and likewise with vitamin D, they say 5,000 units a day is fine. But when you get above that, you run into calcification risks, and that could lead to problems. But what you're talking about, John, is just brief episodes where you up the dose. And the problem is you might feel like you're getting a cold every second week and you keep upping the dose. That's not a good thing to do. So, but yeah, it's making a good point. Number four I had here is that there's numerous commands in the Bible on how we're to behave sexually. I mean, in addition to sexual immorality, basically messing up human intimacy and destroying our capacity to receive and experience love, there are health issues. And so you see, particularly in the book of Leviticus, very strong injunctions. Don't have intercourse with other animals. That's an ideal place for these viruses to jump from one species to another species. And likewise, when you have multiple sexual partners, this again, it provides an optimal arena. And it's now well established that this, in fact, was the origin of the HIV problem. And look at the health consequences we face from HIV. Look at the economic costs we suffer from HIV, and it was 100% avoidable. If we simply follow what the biblical Bible tells us about how we're to behave sexually, we could have avoided that issue. And so there's, not only do we see commands in the Bible about how we're to behave sexually, in terms of how that's going to enhance our relationships with one another, there's also health issues that need to be taken into account. And I was going to go on to explain that when you're living in a situation where there's a lack of hygiene, that's an optimal environment to encourage the viruses to mutate and become dangerous. And again, when you read the Levitical law, you'll see much of it has to do with just good hygiene. So, for example, you're to wash your hands over running water, soap and water. We've been told, hey, if you want to avoid getting the flu, make sure you wash your hands frequently and make sure that you're washing in the right way and make sure that your children and older people are taking care of the hygiene. Make sure they got time to be able to be doing that. And then, as you see also in Levitical law, commands about do not overstress your domesticated animals, your pets, your animals, domesticated animals. If you overstress them, that's a perfect environment for these viruses to begin to multiply. And same thing with humans. Notice all the commands that talks about your laborers. Make sure that you don't overstress or overwork your laborers. And I think that had a lot to do with what happened in the 1918 flu. You had basically had people who were overworked and overstressed for a four-year period. And then when this flu virus came out, people simply didn't have the strength to ward it off. And then what we've been hearing, dietary deficiencies. If you've got a diet that's not bringing in enough vitamins and minerals into your body, then you're not going to be as fit to be able to ward off these viruses, and fitness is a factor. In fact, one of the things they've noticed in the Chinese statistics is many more men are dying from this virus than women. and very few children are dying. But what they now recognize, it probably has to do with smoking. Only 2% of women in China smoke, 50% of men in China smoke, and 0% of children smoke. And so that may be actually explaining some of the statistics we're seeing in China, is that if you're smoking a couple of packs a day, then your body simply isn't going to have the strength to be able to ward off these viruses as well. And of course, if fitness is a factor. If you've got a lot of people that are couch potatoes, then they're going to be much more likely to have a more severe attack than otherwise would be the case. And this is all straight from the Bible, just basically saying that it's good to take care of our physical bodies, keep them fit, make sure you've got a good diet. This is going to help us maintain not only good health, it's going to enable you to be the most productive in your work and your play. So we had another question here.
With regard to the human immune system, I was listening to the radio and it explained, because you know I'm not a biologist, but when your immune system develops antibodies to certain common viruses, you retain that immunity. My question is, they said when a new, would you call it a pathogen? Is that what? Okay, when a new pathogen comes in, your body, it takes longer to develop antibodies to combat that, or in this case, we don't know for sure if it will, but apparently it can. So my question is, if the antibodies, do they kill the virus so it's no longer in your body and you're no longer contagious, or do you just like learn to live with it? That's kind of my question. Do you understand my question?
Yeah, well.
Did I say it clearly?
Yeah, the human immune response system, when it receives an attack like this, whether it's bacterial or viral, it goes after that. But you don't want to overwhelm it. So for example, that's why I was mentioning, if you've got repeated contacts with people that have this virus, or you're basically breathing in huge amounts of coughing and sneezing from these people, and especially from multiple people, that could overwhelm your immune response system. It can do better if it's only fighting a few viral particles than if it's fighting billions of viral particles. Also, if you get to be exposed to these viral particles over a long period of time at a low level, it gives your immune response system time to adapt. And so, yes, I mean, that's one of the strategies we see being used in here in the United States, is trying to delay the onset of the virus as long as possible, because that means that the population here has a better opportunity of being able to build up the immune response. So.
But does it kill the virus? I
mean, yeah.
Yeah,
so basically, it immobilizes the virus, so that doesn't cause a problem. There's a variety of ways. Our immune response system is incredibly complex, and it's designed to deal with these things. But if it's dealing with a virus that's got three new mutations, then it's got an uphill battle in trying to keep that virus in check. One mutation is one thing. If you get three, I mean, this is what happened in 1918. They had this flu virus that ran through the population, and then it mutated again. And so they had a second flu outbreak, and what you had were people getting the first flu outbreak, recovering, getting the second flu outbreak, and dying. And so, and that's one of the things that they're concerned about with this new virus. They know it's mutated. They're doing everything they can to prevent even more mutations from happening. Because if that happens, then you've got something that's much more virulent. With HIV?
Yeah.
I mean, what's your point there?
That it doesn't, your immune system can't destroy it.
Your immune system can't destroy it, but it can immobilize it and keep it under check. And so, for example, if you've got HIV, it remains in your body, but you can actually enhance the immune response system in your body by taking multiple expensive drugs, which means that you can do fine on one condition, that you change your sexual lifestyle. Because if you keep putting these viruses into your body through multiple sexual contacts with different people, than all these drugs you're taking, they're going to get overwhelmed. And so it explains why some people who have had HIV have done well, but those that have done well are those that change their lifestyle.
And they can still remain dependents too, right?
They can, but you need sexual contact to pass that virus on.
Are you saying that even with HIV, your body can develop a response to keep it in check then?
We have numerous, this is why the HIV crisis has diminished, at least here in the U.S., because you've got people that are infected with HIV, but because of all these new drugs, they're able to keep the HIV in check. So yes, they still have HIV, but they're basically living normal lives because of the fact that it's now in check. But again, the condition is that they change their lifestyle. If they keep bringing the viruses into their body, and that's what's happened. You have to use more and more aggressive drug treatments for people that are saturating their body with these viruses.
Okay, but without the drugs, your body's immune system gets destroyed by these things, right?
Yes.
So it can't by itself recover from the HIV.
You need help, yeah. No doubt about it. I remember when HIV first happened. I was at Caltech at the time in the 1970s, and one of our professors got the HIV, and he was dead within 6 weeks. So, because they didn't have anything to help. Yes.
I have a question. What's the alternative to buying stuff made in China?
Well, the point is, these viruses can happen anywhere. Keep in mind, every year we get new flu viruses. That's why they tell you, get a vaccine. And incidentally, vaccines don't guarantee you won't get the flu, but what they do say, if you get the flu, it's not going to be as bad as if you didn't have the shot. So I, for one, get a flu shot every year because I travel a lot. I get exposed to a lot of people with those kinds of symptoms. And I've had mild reactions, but it's nothing like it would be if I didn't take the vaccine. Now, they're working on trying to develop a vaccine for this particular coronavirus, but it's going to be a while. They're rushing this one, and the concern is they may rush too much, because typically when they develop a viral vaccine, they have all these labs work on it. They test it on animals, make sure it works in animals. Then they do limited tests on humans just to see what the side effects are, if there are any. And then they begin to release it to the general population. And they actually tweak the vaccine to see if they can make it better with fewer side effects and more efficacy in terms of being able to prevent people from getting it. Typically, it's a two-year process. And so, and that's where you're really rushing things. So the idea that the CDC is going to come out with a virus for the whole human population within the next 6 weeks, that's not in the cards. It's not going to happen. Because developing a vaccine for this kind of a virus is a very challenging issue. I know different labs are really rushing on this. It's possible within a year we'll have something, but don't expect it to be in just the next few weeks. Over here.
Yes, you started with a slide about the benefits of viruses, and then you went on to mention the limitation benefits of using antibacterial soap and such. So obviously there would be some benefit in not sort of going overboard and kind of over-preventing and over-cleansing. In addition, I know you're of the generation where probably most of your peers experienced measles and, some of the, what were known as some more benign childhood illnesses that we now vaccinate for before 0 to 5, and, kids don't usually get chicken pox anymore and such. So I wonder if you had any thoughts as to the balance of sort of human intervention to prevent these viruses with vaccines early on versus just, letting the illness run its course in a healthy body and kind of like, the benefits versus harm ratio of sort of interfering with the natural course of viruses.
Well, the nice thing about vaccines is you can actually eradicate the disease from the human population. We don't have to worry about smallpox anymore because of universal vaccinations. That is gone. So in that sense, if you can vaccinate to that degree, you can actually eliminate the risk of having people do that. So for example, it's now possible to eliminate red measles and German measles from the human population. The vaccination is not yet thorough enough for that to happen. But I can tell you, I'm old enough, I had red measles when I was a little boy, and it was not pleasant. It's very miserable. It's way worse than getting the flu. And a lot of children died from red measles when I was a child. And I also had the German measles, but I had no symptoms. But I gave the German measles to both of my sisters. And I also had the chicken pox, but I had no symptoms. But I gave the chicken pox to both of my sisters, who wound up getting significant symptoms. And incidentally, that's true of all viruses. You will have a small percentage of people in the human population that get the virus and they wind up with no symptoms. But this is one reason why viruses, in some respects, are more dangerous than bacteria, because you have a certain percentage of the population that has the virus, but they have no symptoms, but they're contagious. They're running around the population thinking they're fine, and they're infecting everybody, and therefore they wind up getting the virus. And that's one reason why this coronavirus is having the devastating effects that it does, is because they now know at least 10% of the people that get the virus have zero symptoms. And then it takes, up to 14 days before you notice symptoms? So you've got people, even those who are going to get sick, are running around without symptoms, infecting people. And one reason why SARS was brought under control quickly is that its incubation period was short. People typically got sick within 2 days, so they were able to isolate them and keep them from infecting other people. And also, more people were likely to die from SARS, which means that stops the virus too, because if the host dies, that stops the virus. So in this case, more people are surviving it. You got a longer incubation period. You got people with no symptoms that have the virus. This is why we see it spreading to the degree that it does. But what I was pointing out here is there's a lot of benefits from viruses, but notice what the Bible says about how we human beings should respond to these viruses. It's basically giving us instruction. Good hygiene, a good diet, don't overwork your animals, don't overwork your human beings, and make sure that you're not overcrowding and overstressing. These are all ways of limiting the damaging impact from these viruses. And now we've got the scientific knowledge to understand why it is that when we disobey these biblical injunctions, we make a fertile ground for these normally relatively benign viruses, like the common cold. You're not going to die from the common cold, from actually becoming more pernicious and more deadly. And incidentally, there's one incident in the Bible where 175,000 soldiers died from a very likely viral attack within a couple of days. Do you remember the story in the book of Isaiah? Yeah, we're studying Isaiah, right? It talks about how this huge Assyrian army came and surrounded Jerusalem and were about to take the city. And God basically, through his prophet Isaiah, said, "Tell the king not to worry. He's not even going to have to lift a sword to try to fend off this huge horde of these Assyrian soldiers. I will take care of it." And in one night, 175,000 of them died. Chances are there was some kind of viral thing that happened, and you got to understand why. If you've got like 250,000 soldiers all camped together in a very dense, all jammed tightly together in this encampment, where they're drinking bad water and they're being asked to do things that keep them tired, it's an ideal environment where the disease can spread and lead to devastating consequences. In that case, it saved the Jewish nation from conquest. They didn't have to lift up a sword. That's what Isaiah said to the king: "Don't worry, you're not going to have to fight. God's going to fight for you. This army will be gone." And with 175,000 deaths within a 24-hour period, the king of Assyria said, "We're packing up and going home," because they were worried that they were going to lose their whole army. Yes.
Hugh, I've read in a couple of places now that some scientists are estimating that between 40 and 70% of the entire world's population will wind up getting this virus. Do you agree with those estimates, and will there be a time in the future when most of us know several people who have it, and how long do you think that will take?
Okay, I'm going to move there right now. These are the latest statistics on this COVID-19 coronavirus statistics as of this morning. And I can tell you the best website to go to is a website that's maintained by Johns Hopkins University and Hospital. They're taking the best data from all over the world, and literally about every 12 hours they update what's going on. And so what I'm going to show you is what they have revealed. Number one, they've been able to determine the time between initial exposure and when you begin to have symptoms. It's 2 days minimum, 14 days maximum. And that's a long time for a virus. So it means you're healthy, you have no idea you got the virus, and it takes anywhere from 2 to 14 days. And if you're a relatively healthy individual, it's going to be closer to 14 days. And so it's the healthy and strong people in the population that are most at risk of spreading this virus. So the ones that are not healthy, they're more likely to see an onset quickly. And the symptoms are as follows. And these are the best statistics we have right now. That 70 to 90% of the people that get infected with the virus come down with significant symptoms. And the symptoms are just like what you get for the flu. You get a fever, you get a cough, you get shortness of breath, in other words, severe upper respiratory symptoms, and you get gastrointestinal distress. It means you get things like diarrhea, it can be spread through coughing, it can be spread through using the same toilet, and that's 70 to 90% of the people that get the virus. And then 10 to 20% have no symptoms. Some think the percentage might be as high as 30% get no symptoms at all. But most people are saying it's at least 10% get no symptoms. It may be as high as 20%, maybe a little higher. Then anywhere from 2 to 8% who get infected wind up getting pneumonia, severe acute respiratory syndrome. What that means is you're going to wind up with symptoms that are going to persist for several months. Of coughing and various other upper respiratory things. And then you can get organ failure, and it's the failure of the kidneys, and then you get other organ failure, and that's what leads to death. So 2% is what they claim the death rate is. Based on what I'm going to show you, I think the death rate's going to be a little higher than 2%. But 2 to 8% will wind up with one or more of these exceptionally severe symptoms. Now, as of this morning, these are the total number of confirmed cases. It's not the total number of cases. The total number of cases might, in fact, be north of 1 million, but these are the total number of known confirmed cases. And for all the people of the world, it's about 87,000. It's actually a little higher than what I got here, because I just checked it about an hour ago. It's now above 87,000. And what you see in that right-hand column is how many new cases in the last 24 hours. And so I think that's what you really need to pay attention to. This tells you how rapidly the disease is spreading. And the other thing that is, I think, significant, if you were just going to a week ago, we were looking at only 20 nations that had cases. Now we have 63 nations in the world that have got confirmed cases of this virus. So that's evidence that's beginning to spread worldwide. China's got the most number of cases. As you can see here, it's 80,000 confirmed cases. And there was evidence in the last 2 weeks that things seem to be getting under control in China, because the number of new cases per day was down around 100 or 200, but in the last 24 hours it was 998. And so this is telling us that it's not under control in China. What I have over there, the extreme right, is W or B. W means things have gotten worse in the last 24 hours than it was in the previous 24 hours. B means things have gotten better in the last 24 hours. And where I put an exclamation mark by it, it means things have gotten really worse in the last 24 hours. So yeah, this is a bit alarming coming out of China, that we're getting not just 100 or 200 new cases, but we're looking at 1,000 new cases. This is coming from, I'll give you the actual website. ARCGIS, I think is the website. But yeah, there's a lot of websites, but from what I can tell, this is the most reputable and the detailed website. And they actually give an update twice a day of what's happening. So this to me is the most trustworthy site to go to. You got a question?
Yeah, as far as actual deaths, and it may be changing now, but it seemed for a while that it was related to somehow to ethnicity or DNA. Like, it seemed like more Chinese people or Asian people actually die from it, unless, you know, you're old and sickly anyway. Now, I don't know how that's changing, and so some of these viruses, are they connected to your DNA or ethnicity? That was one question.
Well, there was some talk about that a month ago, that it was related to ethnicity. Now that we're talking 63 nations.
Yeah.
And actually what we're seeing is that it's the U.S. and European nations where we're seeing the biggest uptick in the last 48 hours. So that's dispelling this idea that it was ethnicity. It looks like we really are looking at like what happened in 1918. Where
for actual deaths too.
Yeah.
They've got that, okay.
Yeah, so, and keep in mind the figures on death. In fact, I'm gonna show you this. Basically relating the number of people recovered from the virus compared to the number of those who died. That's where you're gonna get your best numbers. Because this disease is still taking hold. And so until you actually have a significant passage of time where you can look at the number of recoveries versus the number of people who died, that's where you're going to really determine what the impact is. And then you can be looking at that from nation to nation. But what I can tell you, I'm going to show you the data, but it's really too soon to really say with confidence how accurate those numbers are, because we're not far enough in to the pandemic to really be able to determine the full impact. And but let me go through this.
Sure.
And we'll get there.
Okay.
Okay, what this is showing is that, you know, just a few days ago, South Korea and Italy were looking at maybe 100, 150 cases. They're now into the thousands. So especially in the last 48 hours, those numbers have really ballooned up. So both, you know, we got South Korea's got over 3,000. In fact, just an hour ago, the figure was north of 3,600 confirmed cases in South Korea. And as you can see by the figure to the right, it's moving at a very rapid rate on per day. Likewise, Italy. In Iran, very dramatic, a 30% increase in just one day. Where things have gotten better is Japan. So yes, they're getting new cases, but nowhere near at the rate that they were getting 2 days ago and 3 days ago. Singapore got really hard hit by the SARS virus. But what happened in Singapore is they took action. They're the nation that is best prepared in the world to deal with a serious viral outbreak. And so as soon as it hits Singapore, and of course they have a large Asian population there, a lot of people coming from China into Singapore, they immediately shut everything down. I've been to Singapore. Yes, it's a democracy, but they call it a totalitarian democracy in the sense that, you know, they can really do what they want to do, but based on their SARS outbreak a decade ago, they put into effect laws. So as soon as this virus hit, they immediately went into action, shut down the schools, shut down all the transportation modes, basically put everything in lockdown. What's interesting, they don't have a single death yet from this virus. But also, they've been able to keep it from spreading the population. But there's no nation in the world as well prepared as Singapore for dealing with this kind of thing. They learned their lesson from SARS, the rest of us did not. And also, it's an island nation. it's much easier for them to basically shut things down and quarantine everything to deal with this. Hong Kong is one place where things have gotten better. France has gotten dramatically worse. As you can see here, it's gone up 30% in a single day. They now have 100 cases. Germany, likewise, it's gone up more than 30% in a single day. And then the US, we've had 10 new cases in the last 24 hours. And incidentally, you want to know all those new cases are? Right on the Pacific Rim. Okay, we're kind of in the high-risk area. We would expect the West Coast of North America to be hit first, and then Spain. Spain wasn't even in the picture a week ago, but a sudden outburst. But I think what you're seeing here, with France, Germany, Spain, and the U.S., these are advanced nations where people are in a high transportation mode. So Western Europeans and Americans, we travel a lot. And where you've got people moving around a lot, you've got multiple opportunities for the virus to spread. And so it may reach a point where we basically shut down all air travel, basically try to. That's what's happened in China. They stopped the trains, they stopped the buses, they've stopped the air travel in an attempt to prevent this virus from spreading. And to some degree, that has worked. So let me move on to what I think is the most significant data. And this is the number of people recovered from the virus compared to the number of people that have died. And again, to the far right, I tell you where things are getting better and where things are getting worse. And so this is the very latest data showing that basically for the worldwide, you've got the ratio of people that recover to those that don't and die, it's 14 to 1. But that means that 6.6% wind up dying. Now, I want to warn you that these figures that you see, 6.6% all the way to 37.5% for the cruise ship, these are upper limits. Those figures very likely will go down because we don't have the full number of people that are recovered. I mean, people, when we're looking at people recovered, it's basically people we know have recovered and no longer have the virus. There are still people that are recovering. They're not being counted. But likewise, we're not counting the full number of people that died. So again, that's just a caveat. These numbers are likely to change. But what we've seen is in China, for example, the numbers have been gradually improving. But it's still only 11 people survive out of 12, if you compare those figures. Beijing has got very good numbers. Only 2.9% die compared to those that recover. But everybody thinks those numbers might be inflated because of the politics that exists. And so those numbers, and notice, everywhere else is worse than what you see in Beijing. But even in Beijing, the numbers have been worse. A week ago, they were reporting a death rate below 1%, and now they're up around 3%. And where we see the worst numbers are for the cruise ship, the Diamond Princess cruise ship. They had an attack and basically had to dock and quarantine everybody. And this is the latest figure. Of those that they know that have recovered compared to those that have died, the ratio is only 1.7, which means 3/8 of those that they know have the disease actually died from the disease, which is, means it's probably not a good idea to be on a cruise ship for 3 weeks. I mean, it was a one-week cruise, but then they quarantined it for another 2 weeks, but that meant you had thousands of people in close quarters on a cruise ship where they're all eating food from the same food sources. And so for that reason, on Friday, at Reasons to Believe, we postponed our Hawaii cruise. For those of you who signed up for the Hawaii cruise, we're going to be going next year, not this year. I mean, those statistics are enough. In fact, we have a full-time virologist in the staff and basically reminded, you know, if something were to happen on a Reasons to Believe cruise, we would be held especially responsible because, quote, we have scientist experts that are on our staff. We can't claim ignorance. And so for that reason, we decided to take the conservative approach. And by the way, Friday was the last day that we could postpone without a huge financial cost. If we'd waited even another hour, we would have looked at north of $100,000 in liability. But those of you who are thinking about the cruise, it's going to be next year, not this year. And even though this virus thing is still in its infancy, we felt with these kinds of figures, that's just too high of a risk for us to take. And you know, we know that if you put thousands of people on a tiny ship, that's going to lead to a much higher likelihood of widespread infection. And as you go down the list, you can see that the numbers there. So, but it basically tells you when they say 2% will die, that may be on the low side. It could be higher than 2%, but it's not likely to be higher than 6%. So somewhere within that range. Now, some of the things you can do is get Clorox bleach. And don't get the substitute Clorox bleaches. They're a lot cheaper, but what we do know is a Clorox bleach does work against virus. And you can get these wipes, you can get the bleach itself. Basically what you do is that, yes, go ahead. Wait for the microphone though. Let's get a microphone over to Warren.
Clorox is one of the few stocks that went up in the last week.
Yep, you should have bought Clorox stock a week ago because it's skyrocketing. And yeah, I was at Walmart the other day. They had a whole shelf full of Clorox products because the word is out there. It's really the one easily accessible product that is efficacious against viruses. Not totally efficacious. They say 99.9% of the viruses will be wiped out if you spray Clorox bleach on it or use a Clorox wipe. And incidentally, they're saying that unlike the flu, you need to be especially careful with toilets. And so, for example, if you have to use a public toilet, you want to close the lid, flush it, leave it closed for a while, and then you can go, and then after you're done, you want to close it and flush it and leave it there for a while. Always close the lid, because this is a virus that can come out of the water of the toilet and basically create particles in the air, and that's often how people get widely infected. And so what will probably happen in public restrooms is they're going to have Clorox wipes everywhere, so you can wipe down the seat, wipe down the lid. But the bottom line is make sure you close the lid and flush it before you use it, and then leave it closed, not just for a few seconds, but for a good half minute, and do the same thing after you're done. And if you've got someone with the virus, you need to be wiping down and using this all over the place. So, and again, frequent washing of hands will help. Now,
Hugh, we're out of time.
We're out of time?
Yeah.
Okay. Be careful, though, with the Clorox. If you're washing your hands with Clorox all the time, your hands are going to get really, you're not going to be pleasant. So you need to wash your hands after you use that Clorox bleach, because it is pretty corrosive. Yes, last question. Well, what I've been told, and this comes right from the CDC, is that a 20-to-1 ratio will work. I think the Clorox wants you to use a 10-to-1 ratio. They get to sell more that way. And 10-to-1 will definitely be safe. You don't have to go to a higher concentration than 10-to-1. And Clorox actually sells a spray bottle you can get, which basically puts it out at about that ratio. So there are things we can do. But bottom line is there may become a time when we don't meet like this as a church. And so one of the things where I think we have an advantage, this class is already virtual. If this virus really becomes as bad as what happened in 1918, there may be a period of a month or two where we all meet virtually. I'll show up in person, the tech team will show up in person, but the rest of you may be participating through your smartphones. Huh? They're saying no. Well, I mean, we don't want to overreact. I mean, that's something I think we want to try to keep our society going as normally as possible, but it could come to the point where we're having less meetings. I think this is going to hit the movie theater business pretty hard, and of course the cruise business, but we'll wait and see. We're meeting here next week. I mean, until we're looking at 1 million infected people, I don't think there's any need to take such draconian measures. And so, yeah, we're still in a wait-and-see mode. And, you know, especially if things get dramatically better in China, that would be cause for optimism. Again, I want to point out that because we're such a mobile society, we're probably at a higher risk than the people in China. Well, I mean, yeah, if we keep traveling like we do and meeting thousands of people like we do, but who knows? Things may begin to get under control and things may not be as bad as what people say. It's hard to predict. Just like in 1918, they couldn't predict until they were well into the epidemic just how bad it would be. And we're in the same kind of situation. And so this is the best data we have. But I want to tell you, this is not yet good data. Here's the URL. ARCGIS.com. ARCGIS.com. That should pop it up for you.
What is that?
Actually, search for coronavirus on that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, if you go to arcgis.com, they're going to try to sell you a subscription. So what you want to do is what you heard over there. Put in coronavirus update, and it should take you straight to the John Hopkins website where they keep all this stuff. There's other ways of searching for it, too. What you could do is put in coronavirus, ARCGIS, and that will probably pop it right up. Yeah. And, yeah. Twice a day, the update, and I'm over time, so let's pray. And we didn't get to what we were going to talk about last week, so it'll be next week. Jesus, we thank you that you are a good God that created the bacteria so we could thrive here on planet Earth, and you also created the viruses so we could thrive. And Father, I pray you give us many opportunities to share with people the enormous benefit that viruses bring to our human capacity to thrive and fulfill the purpose for which you created us. But Father, I pray too, you would give us opportunities just to share with people how extensively the Bible tells us how we can prevent these viruses and bacteria from causing more harm than they otherwise would. Thank you, Lord, that thousands of years ago, you showed us how we should then live. And Father, I pray that this viral outbreak, pandemic that is upon us right now will be an opportunity for nations around the world to really get in line with what your Bible says about how we should live and how we should build our civilization and our technology. And we would see people leading healthier lives, recognizing that you are a good God. But most of all, Lord, we pray that people would realize there's a pathway whereby they can have eternal life. Not just 70, 80, 90 years here on planet Earth, but of an eternal life and entry into new creation where there'll be no viruses at all, there'll be no disease, there'll be no decay, there'll be no death. But Lord, thank you for putting us in a universe where we actually get to see your hand at work in eradicating evil and suffering once and for all. In Jesus' name, amen.